So I really wanted to the show. I've been looking forward to this because I saw this damn play, and I said, wait a minute, I should have seen it a lot earlier than I did. And I was angry at myself for not seeing it earlier than I did, because it poses all kinds of questions that are really important for today. And I really, the name of the play is Radiant Vermin, and you had me right there, okay? I was like, you know, oh, come on, now I'm going to watch Rats.
So we had you, but not in a good way.
Right. Yeah, but it worked out, though.
They're radiant, though, so that's the hopeful part.
And my wife said to me, what makes a rat radiant?
Why don't you light them on fire?
Ooh, this is Pacifica. You don't want all these people coming back and thinking you were serious about lighting rats on fire.
Okay. Right, we're not going to let any rats on
all
fire.
Right. Okay.
Or any other.
All right. Let me calm down. Let me get this through so people know who we're talking to, okay? So the play was Radiant Vermin. As I said, it's a really remarkable play. And the director is Tim True, who is sitting right next to me and has just been talking, right?
That's right.
Say hello.
Calm now.
Okay. Yeah, very good. You have that sort of, you know, voice from like, you know, professional radio. You did that?
I've done some voiceovers. Several of us have, yeah.
Okay. And Britt Harris.
Hello.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good.
Fantastic.
Although I'm really a little bit more cautious in seeing your play.
Yeah.
And now you have to help me with your name, Kapil Talwalkar.
Kapil Talwalkar. Yeah.
Talwalkar. Hi. Oh, okay. Hi. And Laura Faye Smith.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great.
You're about the only one in that cast that actually I thought, okay, well, this is a person who isn't like just committing. And then as it goes on, I realized, oh no, you were the person that actually set everything up.
So, right.
So I'm being really careful right now. Anyway, the play is really great. It's Radiant Vermin. And I'm going to start with you, Tim. Tell people what the play is about.
It's about a young couple who live very, very modestly, and they have, all of a sudden they get this amazing offer to receive a house, a total fixer-upper in a deserted area for free. And the idea being that they fix this house up and then the neighborhood will slowly transform. So they take this offer and they soon find out that the house is possessed with this magical ability to transform any room in the house to whatever they're imagining, whatever their desire is. But that magic ability comes at a cost, comes at a very bloody cost. And that's about as far as I'll go. And so the play, as it moves forward, it tempts their morality and it tests them as it continues to develop.
Yeah, it certainly does. And one of the things, we'll get into this a little bit later, but one of the things I really appreciate about it too is that it didn't leave things on the stage, that there's actually a point where the audience it tests the morality of the audience as well.
Absolutely.
Which is like, and that was, when you're sitting in the middle of the audience and you're looking around and you're like, why are all these people agreeing to do this?
Yeah, nobody's let off the hook in this one.
Yeah,
not even
right.
You guys.
Yeah. I said, no. Stop it.
Good for you.
Yeah. Let me tell people right away that it's at the Odyssey Theater, and this is the last weekend of it?
That's right. We close Sunday at 2 p.m. We have a show tonight and Saturday at 8 p.m., and we close on Sunday.
Okay, and I really want to urge everyone who's listening to this, go see it, because it's really – it's one of these plays that just keeps you just stuck in your seat and – riveted to everything that's going on and really worried about the future of humanity. and because so much of it is actually so possible, which is really kind of a deep thing. And you have this, there's a deep morality play that's being presented to people. And it's being done in a way that should challenge the audience to consider the questions of what kind of world we want to live in. And it does, but it's also, you never know what you're going to get when you challenge people to actually decide what kind of world you want to live in. I'm not sure who to call on first, so I guess I'll call on you first.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So, what am I answering exactly?
What the hell were you doing in that play?
I ask myself that every night. There's so much going on, like you said.
Well, the deep morality of it. I mean, because it's like,
oh, yeah.
You know, you go in there and you just laugh your butt off, you know, in a lot of places. And you're just sort of like, you're really
yes.
into it. And then all of a sudden, it's like you're slapped in the head because there's these big moral questions that are constantly confronting you. And I have to say, humanity doesn't fare too well in all this.
No, it doesn't. But that's one of my favorite things about the play is you get lost in it so quickly because it's such good writing and it's so hilarious and there's so much going on stage and so much for the audience to imagine along with us that you forget how terrible it is. And I feel like some of the funniest parts of the play are some of the most like morbid parts of the play. And then afterwards, once you get a second to breathe, because it's, you know, it's so fast paced when you take a second after the play and think about what you just saw. You're like, wait, what kind of person does that make me that I enjoyed that so much? And it kind of poses, I don't know, I always think it shows humanity is kind of rigged because I feel like we have all the best intentions, the characters in the play, but what was the point of no return? It's like everything, we're just minding our own business, having our best intentions, and then something happens, we try to recover from it, be good people, but then it just keeps cascading around us. And then before we know it, we're caught in this huge moral trap. And then can we even go back? What's the point of trying?
Well, the future of the world.
I mean, there's that, yes.
Oh, yeah,
well, I also feel like I'm speaking so cryptically. It's so hard to talk about the play because it is so complex, but also I'm trying not to give anything away for people that are coming to watch.
Believe me, and if I ask a question that goes in that direction, you can just reach over and slap me in the head.
Okay, ooh, really, you're in range.
There you go. Well, now I'm going to move on to, and this is, I have to do this, Laura. You're going to be, is it Laura Faye or can I just call you Laura?
You can call me either.
Okay.
My full name is Laura Faye Smith, so they all work.
Okay. All right, Smith, let's go with you.
Okay, that works too.
Here's the thing, because you know, what we were just talking about is sort of there's this pool, there's this beautiful house, there's this. But from the very beginning, I think you've mastered the portrayal of a really greasy, kind of untrustable, you know, it's sort of like person that's like really going to be out there and like, yeah, I really like it. This is a great deal. But you sort of set the whole thing up, and then it becomes a trap for people in a certain way.
Right. So much about, like, the themes that kind of resonate with me in this when we were working on it that I was thinking about a lot is grabbing happiness for yourself but at the expense of someone else, and then when does it stop? Like, where's your appetite for thinking you want more? And there's that theme that they talk about in the play of too much is never enough. Like, you know, you get a little more, you want more. Like, that kind of top of one mountain is the bottom of the next, and you just keep wanting and wanting and wanting. And then when are you actually going to be happy? So, you know, I think it is talking a lot about consumerism, which is something I've thought about a lot even in my own life, and the way that we measure happiness and measure success. And that if someone came and kind of presented to you, well, I'll give you all these things, all these kind of societal markers of success, but if they came at the expense of someone else, would you do it? And that's kind of, I feel like, what my character is presenting to this couple.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to check with your name again. Is it Kapil or Kapil?
Kapil.
Kapil?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you this, because you're kind of like, you know, I know I've been in this position many times when I've had to make decisions that weren't actually, you know, involving this mass slaughter of millions of people. Mm-hmm. But the fact that, you know, there's a question there where you actually, at the very beginning, you're sort of like, I'm not really sure about this. But then you jump into it. And I was kind of just thinking, you know, it's like the desire for just a basic home life does really, you know, and it's something, it really is that slippery slope that develops. And your character goes from somebody who's being like, you know, so I'm not so sure, as opposed to the voracious white.
Yeah, yeah. I just think.
She knows what you want.
I know, yeah. I just think that that sort of humanity of like wanting that better life makes you root for this couple much more because, you know, there's like this anti-villain sort of like rooting for the villain, but they're not really the villain because they have this sort of humanity about them that, oh, they just want a better life and they just got thrown into this. But you know it's bad, but they stand up for certain things of like, oh, they want to do this for their child and they want to do this for the right reasons. And then you get sort of roped into it. You get roped into it more and more and more. And then you ask yourself, how much am I willing to sympathize with these people and laugh along with them? Until I'm like, wait, this is not okay anymore. Mm-hmm. And by that time, the play is over and you're screwed.
Well, yeah. All right. Now we're back to you, man. I got to hit it. You know, I'm telling you, Tim, this is, when you're looking at this and you're thinking about how are you going to stage this? Because this is, look, there's a lot, look, there's a tremendous, it's like a morality play to a certain extent, but it's not like something that's going to get up and, you know, not old-fashioned kind of, we're just going to have, you know, the preacher standing on the hill in the end as he's dying. I won't go on it because I have a whole big thing about morality plays and dead preachers. I don't know. But the basic thing is that you're standing there and you're looking at this and you're trying to figure out, okay, how do you do this in a way that basically does not make the characters, the two main characters, and it doesn't make them repulsive all the way through, but it actually does trouble people, but oftentimes not enough.
Right. Well, you know, first off, I couldn't have asked for a more amazing cast to make that happen. They all come with just incredible range. And I feel like with the young couple that it was really crucial that they begin and move through the play with real earnestness, you know, kind of an innocence. And if when they begin from that place where they're really, really trying to do this for the good of their child, for the betterment of themselves as a family, not as greedy individuals, that the audience can get some empathy with them. And of course, humor doesn't hurt at all. You know, when an audience is laughing along with the story as it's moving forward, that really helps with the likability factor of it. Yeah, and then the other part of it is pace. I think, you know, the show just keeps coming at you, and it just keeps moving along. So really, you know, there isn't a lot of time for thought, you know, from the audience's point. They're keeping up with the storyline, as Kapil so wonderfully said, so that we have these places, you know, marked, you know, set in the play where the play just stops and the audience is asked to think about it. And that just happens a few times over the course of the play. And that's where I think those doubts start to creep in. Mm-hmm. But you saw it. Maybe you could tell me, like were there certain specific points when you dropped into, like, ooh, this is getting a little too far?
Well, you know, I really enjoyed watching the disintegration of the mask that the characters wore. You know, all three of you. You know, it was sort of, to me, I liked watching it, but I'll tell you what, I was also really uncomfortable about it. Really uncomfortable about it. You know, and I think it because it poses a lot of questions. To me, it poses a lot of questions about what kind of world are we willing to live in, you know? And, I mean, you know, you think – and we're even references to it towards the end of the play where there are people are talking about the people starving in other parts of the world. And, you know,
right.
You know, go ahead.
No, that's wonderful. And I think that's where this allegory, I think, really really resonates in terms of these people are making this sacrifice for the supposed good of their child. But it kind of opens up the world in terms of, like, what we do, maybe even in Los Angeles, where we make choices for the good of our family, for our children, and we put huge amounts of our income towards these things, like maybe the best possible private school, or, you know, upgrading that car, or living in this neighborhood as opposed to that neighborhood. That money and those resources are going for that, you know, that family good, and they're not being used for maybe something in that might be more helpful to the community, you know, at large. So, you know, in a sense, you know, every decision that you're making for the sake of your family financially does have a cost. It has a specific cost. Mm-hmm. That money is not being allocated.
And it has a moral cost, though, in a certain sense, because you do have to – and look, you do have to – every decision that you make in this play in particular, every decision you make – and I would say in society at large, it's not necessarily true that every decision you make is going to have major impact on the future of humanity. But in this one, the kinds of relations that are going to be established with people in terms of how you relate to one another and how you relate to the world are being established by this, by the process that they've gone into, where actually everything becomes, you know, you know, and I have to say, you know, the husband character and the wife character, and that they become, it's a big question for them about, what kind of morality are you going to uphold? What kind of morality are you going to live by? You know, and, you know, it's a huge question that I think actually one of the most powerful things about the play is that it really puts that front and center for people. And there's actually portions of the play where people are really challenged themselves to answer that question. And so to me, I mean, I think like your character is sort of, you know, it's really a tough thing because you're sort of like, you're so nice, you know, and there's Brit and she's like, you know, she's having the baby and she's doing this and she's having a little party and all this stuff. And then there's that whirlwind, you know, everybody's talking at once, and everything's coming out. And it was a collapse, but then something else happens. And that's the thing that, you know, the question of what kind of world are we willing to live in is really the big question. I think that's really, you know, it's imperative today. I mean, people are willing to live in a world where, you know, millions and billions of people are being starved and killed in wars and all this stuff. It's just incredible. And we just shut our eyes to it. And I thought that was a lot of the ethos in the play. So.
I would just say, as long as I'm okay,
yeah,
then
yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's interesting that how the characters, Ollie and Jill, the young couple, how they get like pulled into this whole web is just the pure intention of wanting to bring their child into a better situation than they had, because they don't have much money and they don't want their child to grow up that way. And I believe if they got this same situation posed, I mean, it would definitely be tempting to get a house for free, at this huge, beautiful house. But I'm not sure that, well, from my character's perspective, I'm not sure that they would do it if she wasn't pregnant. Because it'd be like, what are the strings attached? Or at least it'd be a much bigger conversation. I'm not sure they'd be so quick to do it. But I think because she has a baby, like their focus is completely shifted, and their choice, like every choice they make has to do with how can we bring this child up in the best way possible, which is kind of ironic because at the end, when there's a point of no return and they realize they can keep doing, they can keep traveling on this terrible road they're on because they will have children who can then help them. And then it's like, whoa, what are the morals you're bringing your children up with? How did we get to this point? So I think that's the most interesting thing. And it's so dark, but definitely interesting.
You were going to say something?
Yeah. I just wanted to piggyback off that and say that this play is about the many ways that we rationalize our greed through, you know, saying that we're doing it for our children, saying we're doing it for our ambition, saying it, we're doing up to, you know, move up in the world, religious reasons. So it's just really interesting on how that idea is attacked and who loses, because of that ambition, that, you know, want for more.
And then it says something too, and unfortunately I'm looking at the clock and I'm thinking, oh no, where did the time go? We have like 2 minutes, if that. But unfortunately that thing is also, look, there's also an element where people go beyond sort of being fooled by the, you know, or being ruled by ambition. They actually go, and your character, Lars, like, actually is sort of like Satan standing at the door. It's sort of like, come on, it's not that hot. Yeah, come on, jump in.
Well, I think she's saying, like, how far will you go? Like, yeah. You think you're a good person? Great. So, yeah. Like, how far are you willing to take it?
Right, and there's a point where actually, and this is what people are confronted with in society today. What kind of person, what kind of people are we going to be? And what are we going to allow to go on in the world? And that's the bigness of this play, which I think really, I mean, I know the person I saw it with, we were just stuck in the seat after we saw it. It was just kind of like, whoa, this is an incredibly powerful play. And you guys all did a great job. And I want to, real quick, the time, the place, again, make the announcement now because we're running out of time real quick. And I'll do the rest here. Go ahead.
Sure. The company is Door Number 3. The play is called Radiant Vermin, playing at the Odyssey Theater, which is 2055 South Sepulveda Boulevard in West L.A. You can get tickets at www.dn3theater.org. That's theater with R-E. Spelling. The phone number, 310-477-2055, extension 2. And if you mention radio when you get your tickets, we're offering $10 tickets to anybody who's listening to this show, which is a bargain.
Right. All right. Everybody, $10 tickets. Go see it. All right. You can go to my Facebook page for a link to the Odyssey website where you can and should get these tickets. All right. And remember, radio tickets. That's it. All right, and as you heard in the first segments and really already knew, we need to act, sisters and brothers. We need to act urgently right now. So check out those two websites, refusefascism.org and revcom.us. And we're going out with, and I just lost this, but this is, well, you know what this is. All right, check this out. I'm coming to